You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon, episode 134, By Gentler Means. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. This show is independent. I do this all by myself, without some big media company behind me. That's only possible because so many of you have stepped up to put your money behind this project. Thank you for your generosity. As for the rest of you, I hope you'll consider joining us on Patreon. The most recent patrons-only bonus episode included discussions of Basque and Catalonian patriotism and the surprising and unlikely English supporters of Napoleon. The bonus episodes are a lot of fun, and the more people participate, the better they are. You can support the show and get access to all bonus content for as little as $2 a month. Just visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. Anyway, we left off last time in Spanish America, or perhaps more accurately, formerly Spanish America, since so many of these countries were now embroiled in struggles for independence. We last left Napoleon in late 1809. This was a momentous period for Bonaparte, and for once the important developments hadn't occurred on a battlefield, in the political arena, or in some diplomatic summit, but in his personal life. He had finally made his great sacrifice, giving up his marriage to Josephine, so he could be free to pursue a new marriage, to someone who might produce an heir, and formally bind the Napoleonic regime to one of Europe's great ruling houses. As we've discussed in past episodes, by this stage in our story, nothing Napoleon did was purely personal. Even the most intimate aspects of his life could have profound consequences for the whole continent, even the world. This new marriage would be a prime example. Choosing a new wife for the emperor was a diplomatic decision, not a matter of the heart. In spite of his ongoing conflicts with the church, Napoleon was a Catholic, and matrimony is a Catholic sacrament, so this enterprise would involve the church as well. And so, in this episode, we'll be delving back into the shadowy world of international politics. As 1809 turned into 1810, European diplomacy was still in a state of uncertainty. Britain and France remained at war, as always, and the struggle for Iberia continued. Despite the Anglo-Spanish victory at Talavera in the summer of 1809, the French had retaken the upper hand in this theater of the war, as we'll discuss in a future episode. The fighting in Spain was fierce, but relatively small-scale, compared to Napoleon's recent campaigns in Central Europe. Most of the French military was now resting or on garrison duty, with only a minority deployed in Iberia. It would be a stretch to say the empire was at peace, but we have reached another lull in the fighting. To the east, the German states were mostly either under French occupation or locked into unequal alliances with Napoleon. The Austrians were still reeling from yet another lopsided defeat, which had seen them lose even more territory at the negotiating table. During these deliberations with the Austrians, Napoleon had hinted he might be willing to turn the page on the long-standing rivalry between the two countries, but it still remained to be seen whether or not he would follow through. Russia was still allied to France. Although, as we've seen in recent episodes, this was a troubled relationship. Back in 1807, Napoleon had been sure the Treaty of Tilsit represented the dawn of a new era in European geopolitics, but the Russian alliance had not lived up to his hopes. Napoleon's supposed friend, Emperor Alexander, kept him at arm's length, and sometimes treated him more like a rival than an ally. The Russians had been of no help whatsoever during the recent war between France and Austria. Keeping the Habsburgs in check had been part of the point of the Treaty of Tilsit, but Alexander had refused to join the war until a French victory was already a foregone conclusion. Napoleon didn't know it, but before the war started, Alexander had actually provided secret assurances to the Habsburgs, promising Russia would stay on the sidelines if they attacked Napoleon's empire. Alexander had also established a secret working relationship with Talleyrand, France's former foreign minister, aimed at limiting Napoleon's power. Bonaparte did not know all the details of Alexander's betrayal, but Russia's conduct on the world stage made it obvious the Franco-Russian alliance was not solid. Still, Napoleon clung to that vision he'd laid out at Tilsit, France and Russia as the natural rulers of Europe, with the Bonapartes taking the west and the Romanovs the east. He believed in this alliance and wanted to shore it up, not abandon it. And so, naturally, the first place Napoleon began looking for a new wife was the court of St. Petersburg. Alexander's younger sister Catherine was unmarried and about the right age. At first glance, it seemed like a perfect match. However, as you might remember from episode 114, Napoleon had unwittingly made a mistake in late 1808 by telling Talleyrand of his plans to divorce Josephine and seek a more suitable marriage, ideally with a Russian princess. Talleyrand had then passed this information along to Alexander, who promptly wrote a letter to his mother back in St. Petersburg, telling her to find a fiancé for his sister immediately. If Napoleon asked Alexander point blank for Catherine's hand, it would be very difficult for Alexander to refuse him without jeopardizing their alliance. However, if the lady was already engaged, Alexander could let Napoleon down easy. You can easily imagine how this might go. It wasn't that Alexander didn't want Napoleon as a brother-in-law, but he'd made promises that couldn't be broken, and the poor girl had her heart set on marrying her fiancé, etc., etc. As things worked out, by the time Napoleon finally mustered up the courage to divorce Josephine, he was far too late. Catherine was already married to Duke George of Oldenburg. Alexander did have another younger sister who was still single. Her name was Anna. But Anna was single because she was 9 years old. It would not have been unheard of for a girl from a noble family to get engaged that young for political reasons. There would not have been anything untoward here. They would have waited until she was in her late teens before actually conducting the marriage ceremony. Still, the age difference would have been considerable, and it would be years before the two could actually be wed, which put a damper on things. The Russians never outright said no to these overtures, but once it became clear neither side was enthusiastic about this match, the talks slowly petered out, probably exactly the outcome Alexander had been hoping for. Meanwhile, the French were looking at other candidates. Princess Maria Augusta von Wettin was favored by some. Her father, Frederick Augustus, was both King of Saxony and Duke of Warsaw, making him one of Napoleon's most important allies in Central Europe. On top of that, the House of Wettin was one of the most respected dynasties in Europe. They had been one of the leading families in the Holy Roman Empire for centuries. But with the Romanovs out of the picture, and Britain and France still at war, there was only one other dynasty in Europe that came close to matching Bonaparte's stature, and only one country powerful enough for a marriage alliance to have any significant impact on the international balance of power. The most logical candidate seemed to be an Austrian Habsburg. As luck would have it, one of Emperor Francis's daughters had just turned 18 and was not yet engaged. Archduchess Maria Ludovica Leopoldina Franziska Theresia Josefa Lucia von Habsburg-Lothringen, known to her family and friends as Louiselle and to history as Marie-Louise. A marriage between France and Austria would be a stunning diplomatic reversal. The two countries had been enemies longer than anyone alive could remember. In less than two decades, the two powers had fought four different wars. This exact idea of burying the hatchet with a marriage alliance had been tried before under the old regime. King Louis XVI had been married to a Habsburg princess, Marie Antoinette. It had ended with her head separated from her body and the two countries at war once again. Not a good precedent. Emperor Francis was Marie Antoinette's nephew. He surely had not forgotten this story. Napoleon had taken the French throne and claimed to have ended the revolution, but there was still a huge philosophical divide between the two dynasties. As we've discussed in past episodes, despite Bonaparte's crown and his moderate turn after his seizure of power, many European aristocrats still saw him as a trumped-up Jacobin general, the avatar of the revolution, not its destroyer. They did have a point. The Napoleonic regime did maintain the modernizing, centralizing mission of past revolutionary governments. Napoleon was seeking to build a new order in Europe, and the Habsburgs were practically the embodiment of the old order. I think this dynamic helps explain what Napoleon was hoping to achieve with this marriage. Obviously, he wanted an heir and was willing to do almost anything to tip the balance of power towards France. But I think there was also something deeper going on here, a desire for acceptance by the great noble houses of Europe, and more broadly, acceptance of the Napoleonic Empire as a normal part of the European geopolitical order, rather than an aberration brought on by the chaos of the revolution. Napoleon wanted legitimacy for his new order. And what better way than to meld his dynasty with the most famous and visible representatives of the old order? What better way to shed that image of Jacobin radicalism than to embrace one of the most ancient and traditional aristocratic families in the world? This idea of an Austrian marriage certainly had benefits for France, but why would the Habsburgs agree to it? They hated Napoleon and everything he stood for. As we've seen in past episodes, successive Austrian policymakers had been unwilling to accept France's rise. Yes, they had signed treaties with the French when they were forced to, but had always viewed these treaties as temporary setbacks, accepted only out of expedience until they could rebuild their armies to challenge the French again. In fact, in the past, the major foreign policy debate at the Austrian court had been whether they should attack France immediately or in the near future. However, Austria's most recent defeat had brought a shake-up in the foreign policy establishment. As you might recall, the Habsburgs had conceived of the recent war as a kind of proto-nationalist crusade, hoping their surprise invasion of the empire would touch off rebellions in French-occupied Germany, and maybe even lead some of Napoleon's German allies to switch sides. These hopes had not been realized. One of the loudest voices arguing for this war and for the German-focused strategy had been Count Johann Philipp Stadion, the Austrian foreign minister. As the war turned against Austria and the promised pan-Germanic anti-Napoleon movement failed to materialize, Count Stadion had lost the emperor's confidence. However, he was not immediately fired. With the war going very badly and most of the Habsburg realms under French occupation, it was deemed too dangerous to show weakness by firing the country's foreign minister. But Emperor Francis began to turn more and more to the man who had already been unofficially designated as Count Stadion's replacement, the former Austrian ambassador to France, Count Clemens von Metternich. Once the treaty with France was concluded, the change was made official, and Metternich was named Foreign Minister of the Austrian Empire. This would prove to be a watershed moment, not only in our story, but in the entire history of the 19th century. Metternich was 37 years old. He would hold the position of foreign minister for the next 39 years. During the course of that long tenure, he would become one of the most important individuals on the continent. You could make the argument the only other person we've talked about on the show who made a bigger impact on world history was Napoleon himself. But at this point in the story, that was all far in the future. At the moment, few would have envied the position Metternich found himself in, trying to forge a new diplomatic course for a country that seemed weakened, out of ideas, and hemmed in on all sides by hostile states. Many observers of European foreign policy believed Austria was halfway through a downward spiral towards complete destruction. Metternich himself admitted, quote, "It is no minor task to be the foreign minister of Austria in 1809," end quote. At least he had the confidence of Emperor Francis, and that would only grow with time. This would become a truly remarkable partnership. The two men thought alike, shared similar worldviews, and found they could trust and rely on each other. Before long, Francis would come to see Metternich as a personal friend, as well as an invaluable servant and advisor. Historians are very divided on Metternich and his legacy. No one would deny that he is an incredibly influential figure, but whether or not that influence was ultimately beneficial to the world or even to the country he served is very much open to debate. A lot of the controversies around Metternich's career are outside the scope of this show, but I think we can say this much about him without wading into these debates. He was skilled at the day-to-day business of diplomacy, both the external aspects of building and maintaining relationships with foreign diplomats and leaders, and the internal aspects of navigating his own country's court, bureaucracy, and politics to maintain his own position and see the policies he favored implemented. Metternich was highly intelligent and had a clear vision of European geopolitics and of Austria's place within that system. He also understood Napoleon and the French. Before his elevation to the foreign ministry, Metternich had served as Habsburg ambassador in Paris. He'd spent years regularly interacting with Napoleon himself, as well as with key members of the French court and government, and had gotten a chance to observe the emperor and his regime in action. Metternich would later write that this period in Paris, quote, "gave me the opportunity of appreciating Napoleon's excellences, but also the possibility of discovering the faults which at last led him to ruin," end quote. If you'll think back to episode 90, you might recall that Napoleon himself had nominated Metternich for this position, after refusing to accept Emperor Francis's first choice of ambassador. I wonder if he came to regret that decision, after the role Metternich would ultimately play in his downfall. With all this experience, Metternich came into the foreign ministry with a different outlook from all his recent predecessors. Past Austrian foreign ministers had been obsessed with the idea of rolling back the preceding years of failure and defeat, returning European geopolitics to the state it had been in before the French Revolution. As if the rise of revolutionary France and then Napoleon's empire had been nothing but a bad dream, and they just had to wake up. France's rise and Austria's decline was simply a mistake, and once they found the method to correct the mistake, the Habsburgs would return to their rightful geopolitical position, and the world would continue on, much as it had before all this nonsense started. Metternich believed this was folly. The French Revolution and the wars that had followed had changed Europe forever, and there was no going back. History moves forward, not backward. Metternich was an arch-conservative and believed most of the changes of the past decade and a half had been for the worse, but he accepted that neither he nor the emperor could simply wish them away. Metternich believed Austria had to deal with the new reality on its own terms, and when he took office, he already had a strategy in mind. In Metternich's own words, quote, "Initially, and leaving aside unpredictable events, we shall find our safety only by accommodating ourselves to the triumphant system of France. My principles are unchangeable, but we must yield to necessity. We must confine our system to tacking and turning and flattering. Thus alone may we possibly preserve our existence till the day of general deliverance. Therefore, for us, there remains but one expedient: to preserve our strength for better days, to work out our preservation by gentler means, without looking back on our former course." End quote. In short, Metternich planned to adopt a conciliatory attitude towards France, not with the aim of fostering genuine friendship, but simply to appease Bonaparte, while Austria rebuilt its strength and adapted to its new circumstances. Metternich expanded on these ideas in a letter to Prince Karl Philipp von Schwarzenberg, his replacement as Austrian ambassador in Paris. Quote, "Too weak from now on to resist the destructive will of the French Emperor by ourselves, we no longer have a fixed perspective on the role we would have to play if the unified power of the French Empire were to appear at the eastern border. The day Russia will awaken is too far off for any calculations. While our role in the future is subject to a large number of incalculable possibilities, our role at present is dictated by the nature of things themselves. We have to avoid all complications and adopt an attitude that ensures we do not fail at the precise moment that new problems appear in front of us." End quote. Metternich believed his predecessors had been locked into a vicious cycle, desperate to slow France's rise and reverse their own country's relative decline. They had rushed into confrontations with the French that Austria was not prepared to win, leading to costly defeats and punitive peace treaties, which further increased French power at Austria's expense, thus increasing the desperation of Austrian policymakers, leading them to rush in to a new confrontation. Metternich would stop playing this game. Austria would become a perfectly friendly and accommodating neighbor to Bonaparte. Or at least it would appear to be. Eventually, geopolitical conditions would change. They always do. The only constant in international politics is that things are always changing. Metternich made no claim to predict the future, but he would make Austria ready to exploit the situation whenever the time was right. And so, when French diplomats began making their back-channel overtures about a potential marriage alliance, they found the Austrians surprisingly receptive. Metternich had just taken office and was looking for a chance to launch this policy of appeasement. For a second time in Metternich's career, Napoleon had handed him a golden opportunity. Once it became clear both sides wanted this marriage, things moved very quickly. The diplomats worked out the details, and in April of 1810, Napoleon sent an official delegation to Vienna to formally ask for Marie-Louise's hand. This was only about 3 months after his divorce had been made public. He made a somewhat odd choice to lead this delegation, Marshal Louis-Alexandre Berthier, his long-serving military chief of staff. Berthier was an army staff officer both by trade and by inclination. He was not exactly known for his people skills, and was not a professional diplomat. On the other hand, there were very few people who were closer to Napoleon, at least in a professional capacity. I can't help but wonder if Berthier's personal life played a role here, too. Napoleon knew he was madly in love with his mistress, and thus would be unlikely to make a pass at Marie-Louise. You might think someone would have to be crazy to hit on the emperor's bride-to-be, but there are plenty of men in Napoleon's inner circle I can picture doing it. Marshal Joachim Murat springs to mind. Berthier arrived in Vienna on March 4, 1810. Technically, he was there just to ask for Marie-Louise's hand, but this was purely a formality. Everything had been worked out in advance. Less than a week later, a ceremony was held in Vienna in which Napoleon and Marie-Louise were married by proxy. Proxy marriage is a somewhat odd legal procedure that was sometimes used by the aristocracy in this period. The couple in question were not actually legally married until they went through the ceremony in person, but unlike an engagement, a proxy marriage was legally binding. Berthier represented Napoleon in a legal sense, but during the ceremony itself, Marie-Louise's uncle, the recently fired general Archduke Charles von Teschen, served as Napoleon's stand-in. This might have been a bit odd for Marie-Louise. It would have felt like she was marrying her own uncle. But perhaps it was fitting. Nobody in Europe could really claim to be Napoleon's equal, but Charles was the only person in the world who had ever bested him in a major battle. That same day, back in Paris, Napoleon wrote his new wife a letter, quote, "I am counting the moments, and the days are long. My people share my impatience. I have said that you shall be a tender mother to the French. You shall find in them, madame, children who cherish you. I hope you will be persuaded by the truth of my affections." End quote. Everyone knew this relationship was a matter of politics and diplomacy, not romance. But it seemed Napoleon wanted to make it work, or at the very least, he was willing to say the right things. So, who was this young woman who would soon be crowned Empress of the French? Who was this 18-year-old girl who would now be stepping into Josephine's very expensive and elegant shoes? Marie-Louise was the daughter of the Habsburg Emperor. That's restating the obvious, but this chance of birth had dictated essentially everything about her life. She had led a sheltered existence. In fact, that's putting it very mildly. Few people who have ever lived have experienced such a sheltered existence. From the moment of her birth, every aspect of Marie-Louise's life had been decided and planned by others. She rarely had contact with anyone who wasn't carefully vetted by the court and placed into her life for some specific purpose. That especially included men. For young women in Marie-Louise's position, unsanctioned romantic attachments could be very troublesome, even dangerous. And so, the young Archduchess was allowed hardly any contact with men outside her own family, and never in private. This principle was taken to absurd extremes. Marie-Louise loved animals and had a lot of pets, but, by order of the court, they all had to be female. She had very little experience of life, but had a first-rate education. She was fluent or near fluent in half a dozen languages, and could carry on an informed conversation on art, culture, history, or politics in any of them. Marie-Louise was particularly fond of music, and played both the piano and the harp with great skill. On top of these more academic subjects, she had been drilled relentlessly in manners, grace, and etiquette. Everything about Marie-Louise's upbringing had been for one purpose, making her an attractive wife for a fellow member of the European ruling class. It's not terribly pleasant to contemplate. Today we might call it grooming, but this was simply the reality for women and girls of the upper aristocracy. Every member of the Habsburg family had been taught from birth that they had some role to play in the great project of maintaining their family's power and influence. Marie-Louise's father and oldest brother had been born to rule. Her uncle Charles's duty had been to lead the Habsburg armies, risk death on the battlefield, and finally to take the fall for his older brother's bad decisions. As you might remember from our discussion on his firing, Archduke Charles had never complained about his fate. It was all part of his duty to the family, which had given him so much. It was Marie-Louise's fate to be married off to some foreign ruler, just like it had been her uncle's duty to lead the army, then fall on his sword. She never complained either. When the prospect of a marriage to Bonaparte was brought up at court, Marie-Louise was one of the last to know. It may have been her life, but in this era, diplomacy was a man's game. The idea cannot have appealed to her. Remember, she was only 18 years old, born 2 years after the storming of the Bastille, a member of the rising younger generation who had never known the world before the French Revolution. As long as she could remember, Bonaparte had been her family's nemesis. She had memories of fleeing her home ahead of his advancing armies on more than one occasion. As she grew up, she would have overheard the adults around her talking about Napoleon as a tyrant, a villain, and a threat to the family. Marie-Louise was very close to her governess, who was an exiled French aristocrat, and did not have a good opinion of the revolutionaries, to put it mildly. Napoleon had been practically a boogeyman figure for the young Archduchess. Quite literally, we have letters from a teenaged Marie-Louise in which she refers to him as Antichrist and Krampus, after a hideous, vindictive monster from German folklore. Only a few months before the marriage, she had written to a friend, quote, "No one talks of anything but Napoleon's divorce. I let them all talk and do not worry myself, other than to pity the poor princess he chooses, for I am sure it will not be me who becomes a victim of politics." End quote. And yet, when she was finally consulted about the idea of marrying the Krampus and becoming the victim of politics, she accepted it with great stoicism. Quote, "I wish only to do that which duty dictates. When the interests of the empire and my father are at issue, it is those and not my interests which I must address. Tell my father to take into consideration only his duty as sovereign, and not to subordinate this duty to my personal wishes." End quote. And so the young Archduchess accepted a ring from her uncle in that chapel in Vienna, a token from the man she had once called the Antichrist, representing the fact that they were now bound together for life. After the celebrations of the proxy marriage, Marie-Louise and the French delegation set out for the border. In spite of everything that had changed in Europe, and especially France, over the past few decades, the marriage would be conducted with all the rituals and traditions of the old regime. Most of the marriage contract had been borrowed from the last high-level wedding between the French and Austrian aristocracies, that of Marie Antoinette and the future King Louis XVI. When Marie-Louise and her entourage arrived at the Austro-Bavarian border, she went through the same ritual her predecessor had been subjected to all those years ago, walking through a series of three rooms, the first representing Austria, the next neutral ground, and the third, France. In the first room, Marie-Louise left behind all her possessions, including her accessories and most of her clothing. In the second room, she was met by Caroline Bonaparte, Napoleon's sister, who guided her to the third room, where she was dressed and done up in French fashion, symbolizing the idea that she was shedding her Austrian identity and becoming French. Apparently, Marie-Louise hesitated in the second room. Something about this scene touched Marshal Berthier deeply, and he actually began to cry. Again, Berthier was not exactly known for being in touch with his emotions, but he must have felt some responsibility for Marie-Louise. And, stripped of all her finery, hesitating and seemingly unsure of herself, she must have looked very young and fragile. He shouldn't have worried. Marie-Louise actually found his outburst somewhat puzzling. Still, an interesting outpouring of emotion from a person who generally was seen as coldly rational. Although, given what we know about Berthier's personal life, there must have been some wellspring of passion underneath that cerebral exterior. With the three rooms ceremony complete, Marie-Louise and her entourage proceeded to the French city of Soissons, where she was scheduled to meet her husband for the first time. But that's not the way things worked out. One day, on the road somewhere in eastern France, in the middle of a punishing rainstorm, the door to Marie-Louise's carriage suddenly opened, and a figure in a gray overcoat, quote, "jumped in like a cavalry trooper," end quote. It was Bonaparte. Impatient as always, he couldn't wait until the rendezvous in Soissons to meet his new wife. According to one source, he accidentally ripped part of Marie-Louise's dress during this little stunt. Maybe not a good omen. Napoleon was eager to make a good impression on the young princess. He had worried his usual daily clothing, the uniform of a colonel of the Imperial Guard, would be too intimidating and insufficiently romantic, so he'd asked his sister Pauline to help him design a new civilian outfit for the occasion. He'd even taken dance lessons, which is amusing but hard to picture. Apparently, one of the first things he said to her was that she was much more attractive than her portraits had led him to believe. Unusually for a Habsburg, Marie-Louise was tall. She was actually noticeably taller than Napoleon and most of her male relatives. She had blonde hair, light blue eyes, and fair skin, which was unfortunately marked by smallpox scars. At this first meeting, she was slightly overweight, but she slimmed down quite a bit in her first few years in France, and would stay in relatively good shape for the rest of her life. Members of Napoleon's court chalked this up to the superiority of the French diet. But given that she was 18 years old, I would guess this was baby fat that she grew out of. She had a big oval face, narrow eyes, and, like many of the Austrian Habsburgs, a prominent nose. Many at the French court said she was ugly, and while she was not a conventional beauty, I think this is pretty harsh. Perhaps she was simply unfortunate to be compared to Josephine. Marie-Louise was quite aware of the fact that she was always being measured against Napoleon's first wife. Over the course of their marriage, this would become a major insecurity. She told Napoleon he too was better looking than she was expecting, which might have been true. Yes, he was much older than her, but it wasn't like he was her grandfather's age. The emperor had just turned 41. His hairline had started to retreat and his waistline had started to advance, but he was still relatively youthful and generally considered handsome. Although I'm sure the charisma that comes from being the most famous person in the world helped with that a little. This first meeting sounds a bit awkward, but at least they were not repulsed by each other, as some had feared. In fact, according to some sources, they actually slept together that night. If true, this would have been a relatively significant breach of protocol. Yes, they were married by proxy since that ceremony in Vienna, but as we discussed earlier, a proxy marriage was almost more akin to an engagement than an actual wedding. Perhaps breaching protocol was part of the fun. The potential thematic significance of this first night together has been hard for some writers and even historians to resist. The barbaric conqueror from rustic Corsica defiling the naive young blonde princess. The avatar of the revolution having his way with the symbol of the old order. Or, conversely, the most unlikely of romances. An aging ex-Jacobin and a young Habsburg princess somehow finding a true connection across a massive divide, just like Romeo and Juliet. But Napoleon and Marie-Louise were not symbols of grand historical forces and were not characters in a novel. They were just two people thrust into a very strange and potentially awkward situation. They both knew they had been forced together by circumstances, and both wanted to make the best of it. There was no great spark between them. Their personalities and backgrounds were very different. And when circumstances eventually drove them apart, they would both go their separate ways without looking back. But they seemed to develop a natural rapport relatively quickly. I think both of them knew it would take work for this relationship to function, and both were willing to meet the other halfway. The result would be a marriage that may have been devoid of passion and deep feeling, but was perfectly pleasant and civil, and brought benefits to both partners. I don't think they were ever in love, but they found a way to live with this arrangement that left both of them more or less content. Shortly after their first meeting, Marie-Louise wrote, quote, "I find that Napoleon improves a lot upon closer acquaintance. There is something attractive and polite about him, which is impossible to resist. I am convinced I will be able to live with him quite happily." End quote. In episode 131, I mentioned that Napoleon was sometimes very playful, even juvenile, with his young mistresses. We can see elements of this in his relationship with Marie-Louise. He liked to tease her, which she mostly liked and found affectionate, although sometimes he went too far and annoyed her. He liked playing the teacher and introducing her to new things. Perhaps this was natural given their age difference and the vast gulf in their life experiences. Marie-Louise liked this too. Remember, up until this point, she had only ever known an incredibly sheltered existence. With Bonaparte, she finally had a degree of freedom and a chance to see the world, meet new people, and live a little. Obviously, they were not a perfect match. Marie-Louise sometimes found her husband very frustrating, and I think if Napoleon was honest with himself, he would have admitted that Marie-Louise could never equal Josephine, even if he did sometimes praise her for being lower maintenance. All this was developing as the new imperial couple made the journey to Paris to finally be properly married. In keeping with Napoleonic France's difficult relationship with the Catholic Church, there would be two ceremonies, one civil, one religious. That makes three total if you count the proxy marriage. The upper aristocracy of this period certainly liked their ceremonies. The civil marriage came first. It was held April 1, 1810, at the Château de Saint-Cloud, the site of the Brumaire coup which had brought Napoleon to power over a decade earlier. It was a small, relatively informal ceremony, attended by only a few members of Napoleon's family and inner circle. It was officiated by Jean-Jacques Régis de Cambaceres, the arch-chancellor of the empire and Napoleon's right-hand man in political matters. When Cambaceres had said his piece, it came time for the couple to sign the marriage registry. Napoleon grabbed the pen out of Cambaceres' hand somewhat abruptly. Some saw this as another bad omen for the marriage. The emperor signed, then Marie-Louise. 15 years earlier, who would have imagined a Habsburg princess marrying a French general in a civil ceremony officiated by a gay lawyer, making her autograph in the register like an ordinary citizen? There would be a lot more pomp and circumstance around the religious wedding, held the very next day. Napoleon had chosen a somewhat unusual venue, the Salon Carré at the Louvre Museum. This was one of the most famous locations at the Louvre, recently renovated and lit by a huge wrought iron skylight, which at the time was seen as an example of cutting-edge architecture and engineering. This would be a Catholic ceremony, and obviously the Louvre is not a religious institution. This was probably a consequence of Napoleon's ongoing feud with the Vatican. Holding the wedding at a church or a cathedral would have meant stepping onto the Pope's turf, whereas the Louvre was still officially known as the Napoleon Museum and was very much identified with the regime. The Salon Carré was redecorated to make it look a bit more Catholic, but at least one of the guests was not very impressed by the results. Quote, "It was really the most striking thing one could possibly behold, but it was without anything religious about it, nothing that in any way resembled a chapel, to the point where one was somewhat astonished when, by chance, some cardinal or bishop came in and made the sign of the cross." End quote. The wedding party made their way to the Louvre in a huge, elaborate procession of finely decorated carriages. Taxis had been banned from operating within the city that day to ease the traffic. On their way, they passed through the Arc de Triomphe. As you may remember from episode 105, this huge monument had run into all kinds of construction problems and was nowhere near complete. Napoleon had ordered a replica built around the construction site out of wood and canvas, so as not to spoil the view on this special day. This order had infuriated the site's construction workers, who became even angrier when they learned they would not be paid overtime for building this folly. And so they went on strike, which was technically illegal in Napoleonic France. The city's police chief had to visit the site personally and threaten to imprison them to get the project done in time for the wedding. When the wedding party reached the venue, Napoleon discovered there was another strike underway. Most of the women of the Bonaparte family, Napoleon's sisters and some of his brother's wives, had been tasked with carrying the train of Marie-Louise's dress during the ceremony. You might recall they had been assigned this same role during the coronation, carrying the train of Josephine's dress. They hadn't wanted the job then, and they didn't want it now. As a group, they were refusing to do it. The Bonapartes were a proud bunch, and carrying the train of another woman's dress put them in a subservient position, which they did not care for. With the start of the ceremony approaching and the ladies refusing to budge, Napoleon himself was called in to quell the rebellion. There was a lot of shouting and drama. Apparently, at one point, one of the women faked a fainting spell. But strong-willed as the Bonaparte women were, they were no match for the emperor. He always got his way in the end, and this was no exception. The ceremony was officiated by Napoleon's uncle, Cardinal Joseph Fesch. Fesch was one of very few people who could claim to have been by Napoleon's side from the beginning, so it was fitting he would play a role in this new chapter as well. Just before the ceremony started, Napoleon walked the room, just to make sure everything was right. As it turned out, everything was not right. 13 guests were absent. They had all been assigned to sit together, and in this relatively intimate venue, those 13 empty chairs stood out like a sore thumb. The missing guests were all Catholic cardinals. Clearly, this was an organized act of protest against the emperor's treatment of the church. Anger flashed across Napoleon's face, and he exclaimed, quote, "Where are they? The rats. I see what they are doing, protesting against the legitimacy of my line, to bring down my dynasty. The rats." End quote. This outburst was noticed by the guests. Murmurs filtered across the room. Some were simply concerned. Others speculated this was yet another bad omen for the marriage. In any case, Napoleon got over his anger, and the ceremony went ahead as planned. Napoleon placed the crown on Marie-Louise's head, just as he had done with Josephine, with the very same crown a little over 5 years earlier. Marie-Louise also had to wear the same ceremonial fur robe Josephine had worn for the coronation. Two huge, heavy physical reminders of a woman Marie-Louise found very intimidating and was now being asked to replace. Finally, the couple exchanged rings, and the last of their three weddings was complete. The son of the revolution was formally joined to the daughter of the old regime. After the ceremony, Napoleon brought Marie-Louise to the Tuileries Palace. He walked her to one of the rooms, then dramatically opened the door to reveal all the possessions Marie-Louise had been forced to leave behind in Vienna, including her beloved pets. As you might imagine, she was overjoyed, but I can't help but wonder if he could have just dispensed with the theatrics and allowed her to bring these things from Vienna in the first place. Next, he showed her a new piano and harp, which he'd had custom built for her. He told her there were duplicates in every imperial palace, so she would be able to play her favorite instruments wherever they were. Theatrics aside, these were thoughtful wedding gifts. As I've mentioned several times in past episodes, Napoleon could be charming when he wanted to be. After this short interlude, the couple got dressed for a busy evening. There were all kinds of balls and parties being thrown in honor of their marriage, and they were expected to at least make an appearance at several of them. They ended the evening at the home of Napoleon's sister, Pauline, where there was a massive fireworks show. Whatever the day meant for Napoleon and Marie-Louise personally, there could be no doubt that it was a momentous occasion in the history of the continent. Napoleon, and many within his family and his regime, hoped this new marriage would take on a greater symbolic significance. That by marrying into the old order, he had taken the last step towards normalizing the regime. No longer would the Napoleonic elite be seen as a pack of trumped-up Jacobins. Now that their leader was joined with one of the continent's great ruling dynasties, who could deny that the name Bonaparte deserved to be spoken with the same respect and reverence as Habsburg, Romanov, Hanover, or Hohenzollern? Who could deny that the regime in Paris was a legitimate part of the European geopolitical landscape, not some temporary aberration caused by the revolution, just waiting to be corrected? As it turned out, plenty of people could deny those things. Napoleon was strong enough to impose his will on most of the continent, and even to force the Habsburgs to give up one of their daughters. But he could not force people to change their opinions. Many within the European ruling elite had come around to the same point of view as Metternich. They had no choice but to learn to live with Bonaparte for the moment, but they would never see him as anything other than an interloper and an agent of chaos. Perhaps, at least in this respect, the emperor would have been wise to stick to his revolutionary roots, continuing to tear down the old order, rather than looking for an accommodation with an implacable foe. The marriage may not have been a success on this grander symbolic level, but it did have immediate practical implications for European diplomacy. At least in France, hopes were very high. Guillaume Otto, the French ambassador in Vienna, wrote, quote, "Everyone thinks this alliance will assure the peace of Europe for a long time to come, and will force the English to make peace. That it will give the emperor all the leisure necessary to organize the vast empire he has created according to his great ideas." End quote. You can see why he might have thought so, but obviously that's not what happened. This lull in the fighting after the War of the Fifth Coalition is often compared to the period of peace after the Treaty of Amiens in 1802 and 3, a comparison that reveals some big differences. For starters, Europe was not at peace. Britain and France were still at war. The Royal Navy maintained the blockade over the Napoleonic Empire, imperial customs officials continued to enforce the continental system, and French and Allied corsairs continued to raid British commerce. The fighting still raged on in Iberia. As we'll discuss, the French forces had regained the initiative, and many hoped this theater of the war would soon be closed. But beyond these obvious concrete facts, this was a different kind of peace. Back in 1802, there had been genuine hope that Europe might be settling into a new geopolitical equilibrium. News of the peace treaty had been greeted with joy and optimism in almost every quarter. In 1810, Ambassador Otto's prediction of peace and consolidation seemed far less likely. The Continental powers were only at peace because none of them dared challenge Napoleon. Not because European geopolitics were nearing any kind of equilibrium. It may have been impossible to imagine Russia, Austria, or especially Prussia opposing France in the immediate future, but it was also impossible to imagine them accepting this status quo in the long term. This was not the calm after the storm, it was the eye of the hurricane. But this is only obvious in hindsight. Remember, Napoleon did not know that Talleyrand was secretly helping the Russians, in the vain hope of establishing limits on his power. After over a year of hard fighting in Iberia, he was still underestimating his enemy's will to resist. He didn't know the new conciliatory policy adopted by the Austrians was nothing but a smokescreen. While the emperor got to know his new Habsburg bride, Metternich was already working towards his downfall. Based on what Napoleon did know, things seemed to be looking up for the empire, with Austria apparently pacified, France and Russia still allied, and imperial troops in Iberia making huge gains, the final victory seemed closer than it had been in years. The invasion of Spain in 1808 had been a colossal mistake, which had triggered an existential crisis for Napoleon's empire. But in early 1810, an optimistic French observer could be forgiven for believing the empire had weathered the crisis, and better days were now ahead. But the country had grown more cynical over the past decade, and it seems most people were not celebrating the peace, but waiting for the other shoe to drop. As it sometimes does, history would prove the pessimists right. That's all for now. Before we go, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters one last time, and remind you that I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Don't forget to get in your questions in the comment section of the last bonus episode. As for the rest of you, I'll be back in 1 month with more from the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.